Okay, I'm going to cover off the last bits of the main section of the report, and I thought I'd give a little disclaimer about where I'm coming from, which I thought might be helpful at this point. I'm involved in administration of a large repository, and the particular areas of my concerns in the Bodleian are both special collections and archives, as well as IT services. And one of the things that I think is going to be increasingly important is the development of training and professional skills development within the staff of an archival repository. And I think this also will extend to other areas like the book trade, for instance, as we heard yesterday, in particular, I think Steve Ennis mentioned the as digital materials like this gain value, we will expect other people in the chain to have the same level of understanding of these issues. But also, I think it's important for libraries like ours to have the right kind of strategies to develop our ability to maintain our standing as an institution looking after primary source materials. And that's really the impetus for us to develop a Bodleian, the project like Paragon Future Arc. I thought, in addition to the comments that Gabby's just made about authentication and authenticity, I'd just mention one or two things that we felt were important to kind of understand the way that scholars regard the needs of authenticity and authentication. And much of this comes to the scholarly habits of citation and referencing. And one of my favorite quotes comes from an 18th century scholar called Martin Routh, who was at Oxford actually, who, when asked what advice he would give to his students, he said, I would expect them all to be able to verify their references. And I think that's kind of become such at the heart of the scholarly process that we need to ensure that our ability to verify references that are held in digital materials is maintained, and some of the demands of the scholarly community therefore have to be addressed through the application of digital forensics in different and interesting ways. And I think the same thing is going to increasingly apply, as I was mentioning earlier, to book trade, where not only the intellectual value of the materials, the primary sources which they are selling, but also obviously their commercial value is therefore intimately connected to one's ability to verify that material. And I think there is a debate that needs to happen between the legal and evidential side of forensics, which has, I think, driven much of the technical development to date, with the more cultural heritage, intellectual needs of notions of integrity and verification. So one of the sections of the report that we haven't dealt with in a great deal is actually scholarly ethics, but I thought I'd just mention, I don't know if those of you who have been following something of a minor course celeb in British intellectual life at the moment, which is connected to a historian of Russia called Orlando Figes, who is an academic at Birkbeck College in London, who has just been exposed for publishing extremely favourable reviews of his own works on Amazon, and extremely unfavourable reviews of two of his scholarly colleagues, or if I can put it in inverted commas there, Robert Service and Rachel Polonsky. And I thought one of the interesting things in this whole debate, which has unfolded over the last few weeks really, firstly, which has got nothing to do with this, is that when he was first uncovered, he blamed it on his wife, which I thought was just completely outrageous. But more pertinently, that Rachel Polonsky, one of the scholars who'd been, very, very publicly lambasted in this Amazon review, employed the services of a specialist in digital forensics to track down the true identity of the person who posted these reviews. So I thought that's going to highlight the importance of digital forensics in terms of scholarly ethics and maybe a sign of things to come. But of course, the bulk of our report and our thinking has gone on to archival ethics and the notions of ethics that surround the archival process and the archival mission. And I think there are issues which cases like the Salman Rushdie archive and cases like some of the work that we've done in the Bodleian with political papers have to do with privileged access by archivists to digital material. And the increasing sense that this notion of privileged access will need to be managed. And I've been struck by the recent book called Delete by Victor Mayer Schoenberger, who's beginning to introduce the notion of digital abstinence, where fear of unwarranted disclosure is may encourage some to avoid putting material into the digital domain in the first place. And then within the archival repository, there's again the need to understand the requirements for oversight of use by scholars in terms of providing the opportunities for unwarranted access. And some of the issues that may encourage this thought come into the notions of when certain digital forensic techniques need to happen. You know, what is the balance between the work on digital forensics between the archivist and the, if you like, repository staff and the scholars themselves? And I think there may also, this is where notions of trust and ethics kind of blend in together, being able to engender a sense of trust with a data creator, a depositor or a donor of digital materials, and the sense that you as a custodian are going to manage and take care of these issues on their behalf are going to be increasingly important. And also, you know, we're used, very familiar in the archival world to accepting paper records where we will guarantee that they will be closed for a certain period of time. Sometimes that's to do with the legal framework, official secrets and so on. Sometimes that's just to do with the desire of the donor. So, you know, you can tie boxes up with pink ribbon and seal them physically in order to make sure that staff don't have access to them or that, you know, researchers can't stumble upon them by accident. But of course that becomes much more difficult in a digital regime to manage. And so those notions of access controls, both from staff and from researchers, become increasingly important. That's something that we cover in the report. And I think there's also an increasing difference in the way that archivists work with the creators of digital information from the way that they've worked with creators of paper-based information. You know, we're used to kind of thinking ourselves as ambulance chasers as archivists, or even worse, sometimes purse chasers, you know, watching the obituaries close in the national newspapers with increasing kind of concern, and contacting the families of deceased individuals in prominent in public life to see what arrangements have been made for their archives. But of course, the digital domain encourages the archivist to look earlier in the cycle of creation of information and to avoid the need for us to be involved primarily in digital rescue and therefore later on in digital archaeology. If we can work with a creator earlier in the life cycle, sort of earlier in their own career development, often, you have the possibility to sort of build in, to hardwire into their creation process regimes that enable this digital information to be managed by a repository much more effectively. And that kind of sense of training data curators, which Gabby referred to earlier, I think is going to be something that will require greater thought by archivists. And possibly also by people like literary agents or people in the book trade. Those earlier people in those intermediaries, as Gabby mentioned, who will handle this material before us. And perhaps that also means that it's incumbent upon the archival community to perform much more general educational or information literacy to more general sectors of the population about how they manage their information. That was something that was mentioned by several speakers yesterday, and I think it's a very, very interesting idea. So that encouragement of good practice implies that we are able to define what that good practice is, and I think that's something that processes like this exercise we're engaged in at the moment are going to help towards that. We still have a section of the report to complete on the legal aspects of all of this, both from the perspective of the custodial organisations, but also from the perspective of scholars and users of this information. So that's all I have to say.